Blog Talk Radio.
Sexy as you do on the recording, Owen. So
I'm sorry, we didn't do it properly. My voice isn't right.
You're not swirling your gin as you.
I'm not wearing my smoking jacket. I'm totally calm and prepared because of the fantastic intro music we had. I mean, my God, are we invading Iceland? I mean, Jesus.
It would only fit when the two radio shows of Boa and Python come together.
Stop it.
To have
Stop
such
it.
A
We're not, no.
Fantastic
no, 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 no.
Intro
no, no, no. You do not get
sort.
To save yourself for pushing the wrong button. So, I love
well,
it because you started it. You started it, and then like 5 seconds later, you messaged me, and you're like, shit, I hit the wrong one. I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, it's a beam from planet Earth. So I'm cracking up over here.
Yeah, well, we like to bring humor and reptile education together in one, nice
We're
bag.
We're keeping it light, damn it. Yeah, I mean.
So, yeah, tonight. Yeah. Tonight we have the guys from Corrales Radio joining us, and we're going to be hammering through roundtable style, a variety of topics, in the reptile world, and should be a fun time. And then at the end of the show, we're going to hit on Corrales Keeping 101, and I guess since these guys have a radio show about it, I would think they would be the experts.
Well, hold on, because we have a radio show, and I half the time think that we're idiots. So, I mean,
Good point, Owen. So
thank you. I mean, hopefully they're better than us. I mean, Jesus.
That's not that hard. So yeah, so it would be a cool show, and you know, we were on their show and we had a good time, so we figured it would be fun to talk to those guys. And you know, if you haven't heard Corrales Radio, I would definitely recommend giving a listen. Okay, so let's go through a couple things for us, and then we'll get those guys on. We'll get it start going. But Hamburg show this weekend, this past weekend. How was it?
It was packed. Like, the February and the April shows of Hamburg are the better shows, you know, because once people start getting their tax return in, you start going, like, you know, I've been eyeing this animal for all winter, and now I have the extra cash, and some people like to burn it on something. A little bit of it on an animal. So there was so much traffic through the doors. They have a line, and normally you can gauge how good a Hamburg is if the line goes out the door and around the corner and towards the main street. Well, apparently this line that went out the door, around the corner, and towards the main street was there until probably about 2 o'clock, as in it didn't deviate. The line was there the entire time. It was... there was a lot of people walking around. My throat was so sore, it was ridiculous at the end of it. But, you know, it's one of those shows where if you're talking to a lot of people and you're selling a lot of stuff, time flies.
Right.
So it was a good show. I mean, if it was a 5 people through the door show, you want to kill yourself by noon. I mean, that's kind of really how it goes. So, ton of fun.
Anything stick out to you as something that you saw that was like, wow, look at that?
I walked around for a bit, checked out a few things, talked to a few people who are, you know, got their seasons coming up, potential here, potential there. There were, of course, you know, a good number of things that were hanging around. I mean, I walked away with a trio of Savu, and I almost walked away with a pair of Tannenbars as well.
Oh, cool!
No, it was there was a good Hamburg show. It wasn't like the some of the other shows where there's 3 tables of a basement remodel guys and somebody selling little metal lizards he made out of like gears from a clock. It seems like there was a lot of stuff, so it wasn't like filler tables, which, you know, I hate that, but
right.
It was a good show. Yeah.
Awesome. How about, how's our t-shirt sales for US Art going?
Let's talk about that. I want to talk about that. I desperately want to talk about that. So hold on. From where we were going, last time I checked, we just sold two more shirts. So we are at 36 t-shirts that we have sold. So obviously me screaming at you people has been working. So I'm going to continue doing it. Keep buying t-shirts, because apparently there are several people who have approached me saying that they would buy t-shirts, but then don't realize that I get a list of everyone who has bought t-shirts, so you haven't done it. Therefore, you've lied to me, and soon there will be public humiliations. Swear to God, I will do it. I don't care anymore. So, we have 15 days left before the booster closes. 15 days. After 15 days, the booster's closed. The people who have ordered t-shirts will get their t-shirts. Anybody who has not ordered t-shirts, if you email me, so help you God, that you want a t-shirt after the booster's closed, I will drive to your house and hit you with a stick. I swear to God. So, the only way to get the t-shirt is to get it from the booster. So you have 15 days. Order your t-shirt. Get it going. I have to send a t-shirt to Australia and to the UK. And if Casper's listening, he can order his t-shirt, and I'll send it over with Zach Baez and Dave Kelly when they go to visit him.
there you go.
Yeah, Casper. So that is something that can be done. If you're overseas, we can work that out. That's fine. If you're in the United States, you have no damn excuse. anyway. But the grand total of we have raised $215 for US ARC. That comes largely from $4 for each T-shirt, as well as we've had people who have bought T-shirts and then donated money. Dave Diamond put $50 in, and then Christina Carcutt put $10 in. So they've been donating money to the on top of their T-shirts. So, you know, it's definitely – we appreciate that a ton. And I now don't have to be embarrassed by getting a $2 giant check. I'm a little disappointed because I was somewhat looking forward to shaming all of you with the $2 giant-ass check I was going to give to US ARC. But I am very proud of us that we have the $215. But I know we can do just a little bit better. I don't think we're going to hit the 150 T-shirt mark, but I want to say we might be able to get to 50. Maybe. Hopefully. Please. Come on. So it's hopefully we'll see what's going on with that. But like I said, 15 more days, and then that's it. You're done.
There you go.
Okay.
So get your shirt while you can.
Otherwise, it's going to be because the amount of teeth pulling we had to do, we're probably not going to do another booster for a while, if ever. So when it comes down to Morelia Python radio gear, get it now or be jealous of everybody else who got it.
Right. On a side note, you know, all the money's going to US ARC, but I have to give a shout for Jordan Russell and his crew because they raised $137,123 with their auction. So that's pretty good. So congrats go to them. It's all going to a good cause and good stuff. I have, this whole winter has kind of like bombarded us with craziness, and it's been kind of nuts. But I'm starting to think about May and what happens in May. What happens in May is the Northeast Carpet Fest.
Yes!
We're going to be talking that up all the way to May. So we're going to be looking for stuff to auction off. Again, we're doing another auction for US ARC and Rico Walder, split 50-50, half goes to Rico, half goes to US ARC. So if you're interested in donating anything to the auction, and it doesn't have to be animals, it could be gift certificate,
it could be anything.
Your company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It could be maybe you have a cool reptile book or something. You know what I mean? It could be anything.
The thing is that, the first year I donated a hoodie from Rogue. The second year we tried putting animals up. What people are going to do is give you a gift certificate to their company because a lot of people don't want to bid on certain animals because it doesn't fit into their projects. So hopefully with buying a certificate, there's something that I or you or whoever that person is produces that you're going to be interested in.
Right. I was thinking of I might be doing something of a gift certificate to maybe like a clutch that I wouldn't release anything from, or you know what I mean? Like something that's a little like, drives the price up a little bit to try to get money for those two. But if you have anything or you're interested or if you have any anything that you'd be willing to donate, please. We want to get it together. We want to be super organized this year so we have everything ready to go.
We're also going to get food in order as well. I'll get on that as we get closer.
Right. And you can either email us at info@moreliapythonradio.com or PM us on Facebook or, I guess that's the two best ways to get it. And don't forget about the Northwest Carpet Fest. That's on 7/26. So the Northeast is on 5/17 and the Northwest is on 7/26. And I'm trying to work out maybe somebody from USR coming to the Carpet Fest so that we can, present them with the cash and then also to maybe give a little talk on what's going on with rights and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think that's all I got. I don't know if you have anything else, but we can bring. I think I got one of the
Nothing.
Way to come prepared. Bring it strong,
dude,
Owen. Bring it strong.
The fact that I am here.
What the hell?
You should be amazed. What?
Wait a minute. We skipped over it. I skipped over something. I can't believe I totally skipped over it.
What do we do?
Talking about Karma Fest. Last night, we had it was me and you and Zach and Chris and Buddy, and you know, we were hanging out, drinking drinks.
Yes, that is true.
talking about snakes, and you know, it was a good time, and it was really cool. But yeah, something that we have to do again. But one of the things that we talked about was the carpet community, as opposed to other communities that we're a part of, and how freaking cool we are. You know what I mean? So it was pretty cool. I had a good time. I don't know about you, Owen, but you know.
I did. It was good food, good company, good people, and you know, the conversation went well. You walked out of there with a scrub python, so you know it's.
Yeah, I did.
You did. Yeah,
I did. Yeah,
that happened. Yeah.
When you just give me things and tell me to take this, and you know.
Listen, asshole. That is a two-way street. I have a zebra jack and a Jack had granite because of you.
Yeah.
So and the entire Liasis program began by you showing up in the middle of the night with a bunch of eggs and a goddamn necklace, all right? So don't start with me.
Yeah. Here, just take this. Just take this.
Yeah, I don't want it anymore. And then every time you see me, like, God, he's gorgeous. So I'm like, well, I mean, come on.
I gotta admit, before we bring the guys on, I gotta admit, I went over there and I was like, I looked in the in your cage and I saw the maclots there. I was like, holy shit, that was dumb. Like, oh man, what did I do? But no.
No.
Yeah, because they look sharp, man. They look sharp. You know, when they're little, they don't look sharp. But as adults,
no,
he's
one of my favorite animals, and he's such a well-behaved thing. The problem is that the female that's with him is a bitch. It's just, but he's so cool. And I mean, I was playing with the Savus all weekend too, which might be why they haven't eaten yet. I keep pestering them, but you know, the just having them is just been so cool with it, and. It's an entirely different species in a keel, and it's cool when I talk about it now where people are like, are you just do carpet pythons? I'm like, no, I do this. It's fun, and they're just a great species.
Right. Yeah, cool stuff. So it looks like we have both guys on the line here. Let's click them on. Let's get this going. Hello, gentlemen. Is that both you, Corrales Radio?
Yep. What's up, guys?
Yeah. Hey, how's it going?
How you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty well. How about you guys?
We're doing good.
Oh, surviving under another threat of snow, but yeah, normal at this point.
Yeah, right. It's a whole inch.
Right, we had a snowstorm in Portland, but it only lasted a few days.
A few days?
Yeah. We get one snowstorm every 5 years.
Oh, wow.
That must be nice.
Yeah.
It's only 70 degrees here, so.
Huh.
That sucks for us. okay. So we're gonna go and talk about a variety of topics, and we're gonna do this like we did on the last couple of shows of the roundtable style, and go around and. Touch on some subjects, and hopefully, does everybody have their drinks ready for in case the passion starts to go? Because usually these get
well.
I'm already three sheets to the wind, so let's go. Come on, Jesus!
My passion flows once I get off the phone, guys, and I'm not going to comment on that.
Oh, all right. Okay.
Well, just thought I'd make an offer right off the bat.
Clearly, we've been doing it wrong. So.
No kidding, Alex. All right.
Yeah,
so the,
right.
So the first topic that I was going to bring up was your HERP library and the importance of books. And reading and not just getting all your information off the internet, because you could be talking to some 16-year-old kid that has no clue what he's talking about and is giving you all this information and you would never know. But with the internet being such a big part of our lives, do you see books as something that's getting lost with educating the HERP community, or do you think that it's just the natural progression and who the heck cares?
You want to go first, Dayton, or?
Oh, yeah.
I believe you're. There's
you want
a
me to
sequence
go first?
That they had laid out for us.
Okay.
But I could go if you'd like me to.
Oh no, I got no problem going. I guess we'll. Is that how we're gonna do it? Where I go first, and then he goes after me.
Yeah.
Eric's and just gonna. Yeah. That's fine.
Okay. Sounds good. I think it is a little bit. You know, like I think that books are kind of where it started, you know, like obviously people, you know, had hands-on experience, but, you know, we didn't have the internet, you know, and, you know, years ago. And so a lot of the, you know, a lot of the information in the books isn't regurgitated knowledge like what you see on the internet. It's actual knowledge that people have, you know, found through, like, working with, like, initial stock and whatnot. So,
right.
Like, I think that books definitely hold their place, and I use them as a resource, like, pretty frequently. I mean, I'll go through and check different techniques, or look, in some cases, look at different animals and whatnot to, you know, make sure I'm looking at the right thing, or, you know, whatever. But I think the books are definitely super important. I would rather have a book over a website any day of the week, or over Facebook, because
right.
I don't know. I maybe I'm old school, but I think that it's something that's kind of been lost for sure. You know, so
yeah, I would agree. What about you, Dayton? What do you think of that?
I think the the internet is kind of like the fast food of information.
that's great.
But that's kind of what, like, how the world is becoming. Everybody wants, you know, everything that they want really quickly. And the internet's really easy. You know, most people know how to use it, and you can find information really quickly, but you have to cite your sources. You know, you have to know if the information you're getting is credible or not. So you can't just, you know, Wikipedia something and take it as the word. But I do think books are being lost, although I enjoy books and you know, they're edited and peer-reviewed. So that information is credible.
Right.
And it, you know, to the best of our knowledge when it was published.
Right.
So I think books are definitely important, and, you know, everybody should have, you know, some of them definitely relating to the species that they keep, but there also are a lot of good, you know, just general knowledge about reptiles and amphibians, books out there.
Absolutely. How about you, Owen?
I'm thinking that, you know, of course the importance of the books come, you know, when I first started, I had numerous papers, numerous books on how to keep and breed the species that I have that were written by people who were very deserving of the acclamation that they got. They were the breeders, they were the keepers, they were a lot of people like that. And they were very important to and very crucial to how I got my stuff going. Of course, nowadays those articles, those books are almost all digital, and of course the internet is the thing that is slowly killing things like the newspaper and articles, magazines, books, things like that. So eventually, yes, everything is going to be digital. Do I think it's important that you have this information? Yes. Do I think it's important that you read the books that are have been out about certain species, even though the information in them could be outdated or misconstrued at this point? Yes, because it's a good place to start. You know, you read The Complete Carpet Python, and it's like you read it, and, of course, that whole morph section was outdated the second the book was published because that year – how many morphs came out that aren't even in the book? Like, Panther isn't even in the book. So,
right.
But it's a great place to start. All the knowledge that's in it that is that doesn't change is extremely important. So you should still read the book. Just like how you want to read Breeding and Keeping Pythons, the Barker's book. You want to read all those other ones that everybody seems to desperately want for their library, because it's a great place to gain the basic knowledge of what to do. And then the news, as the new stuff comes, those will be articles that you'll read online from journals or breeders and things like that. But it's, again, it's all the knowing what you're reading. I could write an article on breeding diamond pythons. I've never bred diamond pythons. Nobody knows that, but if I say it with enough flash and, you know, confidence, you'd all believe me. So... and it's that's what's dangerous.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I think, you know, with books, my approach has always been, of course, I'm going to buy books on topics and species that I keep. But I also buy books on species that I don't keep. And the reason is because I think the way that you learn is by pushing out of your comfort zone. And not necessarily going to go and buy a species. For instance, I just picked up the complete boa constrictor. I probably
yep.
won't ever keep boa constrictors, but I see a lot of correlations between boa constrictor and carpet pythons, or you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, okay,
mm-hmm.
well, you know, let's see, you know, how is this, why is this a species and this is a subspecies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and... you know, and I think another one that I picked up was How Snakes Work by Dr. Lillywhite that gave this speech at ICAST. I mean, that book is, like, incredible. And it doesn't really talk about carpet pythons at all or Morelia, but I think it's important on learning what's going on with your snake, because if you read that and you understand that, I think it gives you, the keeper, a better place to be able to take care of situations or problems, or if it's not breeding, if it's not eating, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as a way to fix those and be successful at keeping the species, you know. So, okay, what about your favorite title and why? How about you, Jeff? What's your favorite title?
Well, honestly, one of the first books that really got me jazzed was the Kaleidoscope Tree Boa book, which is pretty much a complete guide to the Corallis genus. It's kind
okay.
of an older book, probably in some ways outdated, but one of the things I like so much about it is, like, the old pictures that are in it, you know, of, like, back in the days of, like, heat lamps and aquariums and stuff, and lots of wild, you know, photographs from animals that, you know, were found on site, like in the wild. And it just is a really good book that, you know, I don't really think a lot of things have changed. I guess in some ways with like tree boas or with pythons maybe, but like the foundation or the basics is still the same, you know?
Right.
There's still,
right.
like, certain needs that need to be cared for. And I really like this book because it, you know, pretty much touches on any kind of boa species that's arboreal and lives in the neotropics, you know, being,
okay.
like, Central and South America. I also really like I really like the Complete Carpet Python, guys. I mean, I've been a carpet
mm-hmm.
geek since I was a kid, or since I first got my, you know, first snake, and which was a, you know, coastal, and so I, you know, I really liked that book, you know, and pretty much same reasons. I like seeing the pictures of the stuff in the wild. I really
right.
do, and I have a, you know, I think there's so much that's unappreciated with these species that we keep in our homes, and we think, you know, they're really cool, and all of our focus is on, like, what's here and what's accessible and, like, what the color patterns are and everything, but, like, we forget, like, the real deal, so to speak. We forget, like, the purest side of it, and that's, you know, the untainted, you know, completely wild version of that animal, and has had no contact with humans, no interference, nothing. It's just raw and uncut. And I really like seeing those pictures, because I, you know, unfortunately can't go to Oz to see pictures of them myself, or, you know, get down to South or Central America. So I, you know, I really like the field data, which I think that's been lost in captivity in a lot of ways. You know, I think that we try to accommodate our needs as opposed to the animals' needs. And,
right.
you know, what works best for us isn't necessarily what always works best for the animal.
Gotcha. Okay. How about you, Dayton?
When I first started getting into Amazon tree boas, I asked around, as a member of a forum, I asked around, you know, what are some good books that I should get? And a common one was Neotropical Tree Boas by Robert Henderson, Dr. Robert Henderson. And well, it's hard to find good books on tree boas. And
right.
for keeping them in captivity, that isn't one of them. It's basically just raw data, you know, scale counts and heights of that he captured tree, you know, tree boas. And its main focus is the Grenadian tree boa. My favorite book would probably have to be the More Complete Chondro by Maxwell. And the reason is because he does go off on, like, rants that I kind of lose interest in, but it's focused on chondros in captivity, and obviously that's information that you need if you're keeping chondros, how to keep them in captivity. And he's not very opinionated, so he just kind of offers up, you know, different perch styles and different cages that he's used, and they all work, and, you know, different ways you can set up your habitat, and it still works.
Right.
And it's all about, for the most part, you know, captive husbandry. So I thought that was a really, really good book, even though a lot of people would disagree with me.
Yeah. What about you, Owen?
I would definitely say The Complete Carpet Python, because out of all those other books, I kind of was the guy that was like, oh, yeah, let's borrow a friend's, and then I'd read it, give it back, or, you know, get pretty much the gist of them online. But The Complete Carpet Python was the book I had to have. And so far I've bought three copies of it. I bought one for myself, one for a friend of mine who was doing carpet pythons, and then I spilled a bunch of shit on my first copy and had to buy another one. So it's a book that I think you need desperately if you're doing Morelia, because not only is it, hey, this is how it's kept in a bin, it's, hey, this is what its natural habitat looks like. This is where they found it. This is what you can do. This is some of the shit we've seen, and it's extremely helpful.
Okay. I guess I kind of am torn with this, because I guess when I would say my favorite book came out, there was no Complete Carpet Python. But I have two of them. One would be Pythons of the World, Volume 1, by Dave and Tracy Barker, just because of my fascination with pythons from Australia. I mean, that book is pretty much the end-all, be-all for pythons of Australia. I mean, is there anything better? I don't think so. Looking at some of the, you know, back then, I guess when that book came out, there was really no morphs or anything. I guess there was an albino carpet python, and that's about it. So at least that people knew about. And, you know, most of the stuff that's in there is all, you know, wild pictures that they took when they were there. Just tons of info in there, both field and captivity. It's kind of a more scientific type of book. So it's more like it reads like a paper rather than a book. But mm-hmm. great thing. It's hard to find. But if you can get your hands on it, I would highly recommend it. And then I guess the other one would be the quote-unquote Blue Bible, The Reproductive Husbandry of Pythons and Boas by, Richard Ross and Gerald, I think his name is Marsak. I know a lot of the stuff in there is dated. Maybe things are done different, but, I mean, as far as if you're breeding boas and pythons in captivity, that's an awesome reference tool to be able to look at and just give you a basic overall feel of how you breed boas and pythons in captivity. So that's a good one as far as I'm concerned. And, of course, I love The Complete Carpet. But, you know, I think that I carry that around with me and take it into my bed and put it on the side of the bedpost and you know, but yeah, I would have to say those other two. What about a book that you would like to own but you can't find, or it's out of print, or what would it be for you, Jeff?
I'm an idiot because I had a lot of books, and I got out of reptiles for a few years and was like, here, I'll just give them away. I don't even know what I didn't throw them away, and I didn't sell them. I gave them away.
Okay.
So.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm, you know, stupid. But, I really don't have any that are out of print that, you know, I really want to find. There are some books that I'd like to get that I can get. I just haven't got them yet. One would be The Complete Children's Python, just because I love Antaresia and I think they're really cool. And, you know, I've got a pair of children's pythons, and I'd like to learn more about them. And I'd like to get The Reproductive Husbandry of Pythons and Boas for pretty much the same reasons you named. I don't know, man. I've kind of gotten to where I really like some of the journals that are out there, to be honest. I've got some journals from Robert Henderson he's the guy that wrote that Neotropical Tree Boas book that Dayton mentioned, and I'd like to pretty much get anything I could get my hands on from him. Right. And some of it requires a lot of digging. I've spent a lot of time on Google Scholar trying to find, you know, journals and stuff that have been digitized and, you know, put online, but that's probably the most difficult thing that I'd like to get my hands on.
Okay. How about you, Dayton?
The book How Snakes Work is next on my wish list. I just saw it on Facebook the other day, and I read the description of it. And
oh yeah, it's awesome.
I think that'd be pretty cool. So
yeah,
I like. I don't know. It looks like it's gonna have some good pictures in it. Not to sound like I like picture books or anything, you know, but I'm more I like, you know. I'm a magazine kind of guy.
You'll
have a shorter attention span. So.
I think in that book he kind of made it scientific, but being able to read it, if that makes sense.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like you can digest it. So I think you'll like that. So cool.
Yeah. No, and it seems to be mainly about the anatomy of, you know, snakes in general and just the cool adaptations and everything like that. So,
yeah. He gave an awesome talk at ICAST, by the way, just about about that. It was as soon as I heard him talk, I knew I wanted to get that book. So it's awesome. How about
I toyed around with the idea of making the trip out there to go to that, but just didn't get around to it.
Right.
It was a fun time.
Yeah. How about you, Owen?
Actually, the book I want is actually one I had, and then it was taken. It was for my herpetology class in college. It was the Clinical Anatomy and Physiology of Exotic Species, and it was pretty much the inside outs of how snakes worked as well as what they knew about certain diseases and how they function, how they work through the body and things like that of a reptile. It basically told you breakdown of, like, an RI or something like that from beginning to end, and it was extremely useful, and I was through the process of reading it when a friend's girlfriend was taking herpetology and borrowed the book, and I never got it back. So I found it online, but it's like $800. So I don't want it that badly. that's probably the only book I would really miss. As far as other things, I mean, I just enjoy finding the old articles that are meaningful. Like, I have a Vivarium magazine that talks about the first tigers. That article, that classified ad, that says the tiger is a brand new codominant morph of carpet python. So, and that, of course, is what led to the original line of tigers. So.
Right.
Yeah, I enjoy that.
Mine would be A Guide to Snakes of Papua New Guinea by Mark O'Shea. That's one I definitely want to get my hands on, but it's hard to come by. I'm thinking of the scrub pythons, bolans, chondros, you know, all those other species that are up north of Australia. And I think that would be a good book. I saw it once at Hamburg, and I should have picked it up, and I didn't, and then the guy didn't have it again. Remember the guy that was across from us, Owen, when we were vending the show?
Yeah.
Remember? Yeah. I saw it there.
Yeah, like, well, it's funny because there used to be, at Hamburg, two tables worth of books in the back. And that guy got kind of kicked out of Hamburg, and his tables are now filled with, like, boas. So, you know, I can understand why they would want to fill the table with more reptiles, but I also really enjoyed seeing the literature there. Because, I mean, there were several times where that's where I got my first copy of The Complete Carpet Python. I was there, and it was there, and I'm like, holy crap, and I just got it. I mean, and I'd seen The Complete Chondro there, and a bunch of other things that you could have possibly grabbed to learn about the snake that you either were thinking of buying, just bought, or, you know, saw for the first time.
Right.
So, heaven forbid we try to educate the public.
Yeah, I think, I guess my thing I would say is that if you have a chance to pick up a book or any of the ones that we talked about, actually the Treboa ones have me kind of intrigued, so I might have to track down some of those titles that you guys mentioned, but I would definitely try to pick them up and educate yourself, you know. Knowledge is power, but hopefully that doesn't get lost, kind of like the forums have, you know. So the next topic, well, that really wasn't all that, you know, we didn't really battle out or anything, you know what I mean? What the heck? So you're going to have to bring
it up. I disagree with Eric's thing. I don't know, what do you want?
This one, you know, you know, we always talk about breeding on the show and people, you know, I guess on other shows, they focus on it as well. I think it could be safe to say that, you know, for breeding boas or pythons, you know, pretty much there's a lot of ways to do it. There's many factors at play. I guess my thought would be, what do you think is the most important factor for breeding pythons and boas in captivity and why? Maybe you can switch between the two. Both you guys keep both boas and pythons, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe you want to switch between the two. Maybe you think it doesn't matter. Boas, pythons, all the same. What do you think? You know, Jeff, what do you think is the most important thing? Like, you can't start a season or have a season without hitting this certain thing?
Well, I don't have a ton of experience breeding, but I would say there are probably three really important things. A is to know the seasons where you live. B is be consistent with whatever you're doing. Be consistent with it. And the third thing is make sure that there's something in there that is, I guess, weather or season-wise would be change. You know, like make sure you're doing something in there that is going to signal, hey, you know, this is a break in the consistency, so to speak, so that they can, so something tells their bodies to get into a different mode, which would be breeding. You know, like I have grown up in Florida my whole life, and I now live in Sacramento. I've been out here a year. I can't keep my snakes the same way I kept them in Florida. It just will not work. It is so much drier here. I mean, we maybe get under 14 days of rain a year, and in Florida, I got like, I mean, it takes a week of straight rain to get 3 inches of rain here. You can get 3 inches back in Jacksonville in like 30 minutes. Like, so, I mean, for tree boas, that creates a huge, you know, change in your husbandry because you now are trying to get things humid and keep things humid, whereas in Florida, I was constantly trying to make things drier because humidity would just stay. And so, you know, and that can create huge problems when you're going into, you know, dropping temps and all that stuff because, you know, you've got these animals that are used to a really wet condition, and then you go and start dropping temperatures, you could be setting them up for a lot of RI infections, you know, if you're not, I guess, doing it in steps, you know. And I know I used to keep chondros quite a bit, and I know chondros, they don't handle temperature fluctuations very well. I know from my animals, and I know from other guys that have been breeding them for years, you have to be, you know, subtle is key with those guys. And you know, so I think knowing where you live, you know, what your seasons are, where you're at, is going to be a big thing. You can't keep your animals the way, you know, and plan to get the same results whenever you move into a different climate. And I think whenever you're keeping your animals, you know, because we don't just like start thinking breeding when it starts getting cold. I mean, pretty much we're prepping and thinking about pairings and doing all these things the entire year. And so I think you got to be consistent in your husbandry and make sure that you are, you know, you're not throwing curveballs at them all the time. You know, they're in a routine, you know, they're, you know, everything's, you know, solid and you know, second nature for you and for the animal. And then, you know, you start doing things a little bit different to get them, you know, when temperatures start to drop, you start, you know, I'm a firm believer in cycle feeding, you know, because I think that, you know, is one subtle cue you can give them to, whether it be pythons or boas. I also think dropping temps, you know, being super subtle. Like this year, the way I approached it, even though the one pairing I had going turned out to be two males, so it didn't work out for me too well, but they were producing sperm, both of them. And, and I never saw any combat, so it totally turned me off. I don't know. Maybe they were gay. I think they were. Actually, no, because I shipped one to Joe Simonson, and he's already locking up a bad owl. So,
there you go.
Anyway, you're welcome, Joe. What I did with those guys is, you know, I had them in pretty big cages, so there was a big fluctuation in temperature from one side to the other. And I just, you know, 1 week I would drop it, turn all the heat off for like a few hours, like 4 hours. Next week, I'd bump it up 2 more hours, and the next week, I'd bump it up 2 more hours. And within, like, the second week of dropping the temperatures off, I mean, they were all feed and, you know, looking for females. So, and I did the same thing with my tree boas back when, in chondros back, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when I had an adult colony of each one of them. So, you know, I think consistency and just, you know, a little bit of change. It doesn't have to be anything too drastic, really. I don't think so. But I don't know. Maybe Dayton or you guys are better people to talk about that.
Well, so I guess I've got a simple answer and then a more complicated answer. The simple answer is you need the right male. And you don't want to stretch your males too thin. So if you're building like a breeding colony, you don't want to have too many females. Everyone is worried about having enough females, but you really need to worry about having enough males.
Okay.
If you've got one male and you're really planning on him breeding and he doesn't breed, it can really screw you up. So have a backup.
Right.
Switch hitter, yep.
If the male doesn't breed the female, you're not going to get any babies. That's just plain and simple.
All right.
And then I guess the more complicated answer is find out what works for you. So know the species and know the, you know, general needs that they have, and then tweak them to your location, basically. So you can find the knowledge out there, you know, what temperatures they like or, you know, prefer, you know, humidity range and type of prey and stuff like that.
Right.
But then you have to find what works for you, where you're living. And Jeff touched on this a little bit, you know, the difference between California and Florida. When I first started breeding tree boas, most people were cycling in fall and, you know, getting breeding in the winter. And I think that's kind of maybe tailored to East Coast. But on the West Coast, I didn't get any breeding until springtime. So, you know, April, May. And I would get breeding and eventually, you know, have offspring from that. I would have offspring late summer, early fall. And if you listen to our episode when we were talking about tree boas with Rory Gresko and Charles Koutras,
right,
both noted similar things, getting breeding in the spring here on the West Coast.
Why do you think that is? What do you think is the difference between the East Coast and the West Coast? Just the temperature? Is it barometric pressure?
Maybe it's a
weather?
Seasonal thing.
Right.
Definitely think what is it? You know, storm systems definitely stimulate breeding, and your animals pick up on that.
Right.
But our winters are pretty mild, and it rains most of the winter.
Right.
So I guess I'll just give you a basic. I heat my room. And so in the winter, it's colder. My daytime highs are a little lower, and it's usually drier because my heater is running more often.
Okay.
And then in the springtime, you know, and in the summertime, the temperatures are getting a little higher. It's getting more humid, less dry.
Right.
And so it's kind of like a natural cycle.
Gotcha. Okay. That's interesting because I know talking with Nick, he always goes later than me. So when we're talking breeding carpet pythons, he's like usually off from where I'm at, you know? So,
right.
I never heard that before until now, but that's interesting. Huh.
And Nick's he's a closet tree boa lover too. So.
yeah, I know. what about you, Owen?
I think that there are 10 million ways to skin a cat when it comes to getting reptiles to breed, especially snakes. And we discussed this a little bit last night. I mean, everything from a cool down to food deprivation to monsoons to just tossing them in and seeing how it goes. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do. What works for me is the food deprivation as well as a drop in temperature. Even then, I still get late clutches. I mean, I had that one clutch drop in July, which is late for me and hatching September. So, you know, there's always exceptions to the rules, and there's always a new way of thinking and a new way of doing. But for me, the critical thing is, of course, food becomes scarce and the temperature drops.
Okay. well, for me, I guess I would think that with just really ever breeding carpet pythons, I think the most important part of it is that they have to be cooled. And I don't really think that temperature is really a huge factor in as far as how you do it, but I don't notice anything in my snakes. And I've bred, this is the fourth year, and 2 years I didn't cool, I didn't get any success. The 1 year I did cool, and this year I did the same, I noticed I got success. Well, I don't know about this year yet, but I'm on the right path.
Yeah,
you count
those eggs before they're laid, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I can't really speak to that yet, but I kind of think I have a thought that, and I'm curious, did you guys have good seasons last year, Jeff and Dayton?
I didn't last year. I wasn't keeping anything last year.
Okay. How about you, Dayton?
Well, I'm thinking 2012. What year? It's 2014. I didn't have anything that was old enough to breed last year.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How about you, Dayton?
I had 4 litters of tree boas and a clutch of green tree pythons.
So is that your average, or is that?
That's kind of what I could average out at. That's a good year for me. The year before, I had 4 litters of tree boas as well. So.
Oh, okay. Well, then my theory is shit, because my thinking is that, and no one will attest to this, last year the carpet breeding season on the East Coast was horrendous. People did have success, but the overall, and this could just be my perception, but it just seemed like everybody was complaining about that the season was off, that the season, you know, that they weren't breeding, or, you know, they didn't have as many clutches as they thought. And I remember Nick was telling me that the year before he had shit luck, and last year he had great luck, and he was attesting it to the weather. Now, this last year we didn't have shit as far as weather goes. This year we're getting clobbered with, you know, with storms upon storm upon storm, and I want to see if East Coast this time comes out with more success. You know, curious.
I've already got one pairing well underway with my tree boas.
Okay.
I wonder how people are going to be doing in California, because California has had in Sacramento we've had a record drought. There was one time we had less rain, or we had almost less rain, and that was like 1978. So this is the driest it's ever been in history, and I mean record highs for this time of year all over California. So I'm curious to see how, you know, the carpet and, you know, the python and boa breeders do up here. I don't know too much about the Northwest, but.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Jeff, you had hit on food cycling when you were talking earlier. Is there any more to, like, when you say food cycling, see, to me, I used to think of food cycling as, okay, I don't feed, then I just start upping the amount, how often I'm feeding. But I listened to Vin Russo talking about it the other day, and he's doing something completely different than what I would have thought to do, where he may be just pounding his boas with, you know, feeding them every day. And the thought was is that, you know, I guess migratory birds are coming in, or, you know, and, you know, they have to feed in that limited amount of time for the rest of the year. Is that how you're approaching it, or are you just kind of like up in the food?
I'm growing a lot of my stuff up right now. I don't have any adults. But I'm doing the opposite thing with my boas than I am with my pythons. My pythons, I'm hardly feeding them at all, even the two-year-olds. I'm not giving them much of anything, maybe one or two rodents a month, if that, you know. But my boas, yeah, I'm like offering them every week if I can get them that, because I'm trying to, you know, beef them up a little bit. But, you know, that is a good point, you know, that the migratory birds and stuff that fly south, which would be where these animals are coming from boa-wise, they have much more, you know, food sources this time of year. But the same token, their seasons are a complete opposite of ours. So it's cold here, but it's warm down there. So I don't know how much of his theory holds weight. Not saying that, you know, it doesn't hold any weight, but having lived down there, I know that our, you know, January and February, December, January, and February are like the July, August, and September. So, like for us, we're thinking, oh, it's like super, super cold, but it would be opposite for them because they're having much more food during the warmest parts of the year for them. So, I don't know.
Right.
It's
yeah. You know, I don't know if it. I don't know if he necessarily is saying it has anything really to do with. I could be wrong, but I'm not sure what he's doing as far as temperature, but I think he was just saying that, you know, basically it's seasonal. They come down, then that's when the boas know, okay, it's time to breed because it's time to feed type of thing. So they're filling themselves up, and there they go, and then it's time to breed. So he's just trying to, you know, replicate that in captivity, so to speak. And then he's getting, I guess he's getting success, you know, because it's his way of cycling instead of temperatures or light or, you know. So,
light cycles will never play into a boa in Central and South America because there are no light cycles. You're so close to the equator, it's 12 hours pretty much year round.
Right.
So I don't buy into that. I think that if people are having a lot of success with that, I think it's based on something else. It's definitely not going to be light cycle because there is no change in light cycle there.
Right.
As far as, I think when you're dropping temperatures, I think it's more taxing on the animal if you're feeding them a ton. Like right now, like, I don't really have any. I'm not really dropping my temperature. My temperatures for my tree boas are not cooler than my temperatures are as cool as they are for my pythons. My pythons are getting cooler temperatures, and I'm not even pairing any of them up. But I'm kind of getting them in that routine of, you know, this time of year temperatures start to drop. And you know, I think the animals also sense the pressure changes in the air, you know, with all the storms and stuff that come through, especially on the East Coast and probably up where Dayton's at. I think they can feel that, you know, all those changes and definitely triggers their bodies. So, you know, I don't know. Those are my thoughts on it.
Okay. Anybody else have anything other than that? We'll move to IBD.
Don't say those letters.
I mean, I got to be honest.
there's a lot of boas I really dig. I really like boas. But I think what keeps me away from them is that word, those three letters. So as guys that keep both boas and pythons, I figured who better to talk to than to you guys, and maybe you can give us, you know, what's your thoughts on it? Is it, because to me it seems like, and this could just be, again, my perception, but it doesn't seem to be as something that's talked about in pythons as much as it is in boas. And I don't know if you see the same thing, or python people just being assholes or whatever. What do you think?
Beating themselves.
Yeah.
I just think it affects them differently. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I don't know a whole lot about IBD, but what I do know is that mites are probably one of the biggest carriers.
Yes.
They carry a lot of other things too, but I actually know of a really, I'm not going to say his name, but there is a breeder who works with pythons and works with colubrids, and did not have a single boa, to my knowledge, in his collection. And he lost almost all of his pythons due to IBD, and none of his colubrids were affected.
Huh.
He, like, went through heavy quarantining and testing and stuff like that to try and like locate where it was coming from, and supposedly all of his results came back that his colubrids were clean, and that, you know, the issue was with his pythons, and he didn't keep any boas. But I think quarantine's a big thing. It should be standard practice, and I'll be the first to admit I'm guilty of probably slacking on it sometimes. You know, you get an animal that you're really, really excited about. The last thing you want to do is, like, tuck it away somewhere and, you know, isolate it and put it in, like, the barest conditions possible. You know, I think that quarantine probably is something that gets kind of thrown to the wayside, is not as important, but I think it's really important, because something about, you know, the biggest way to, one of the biggest, two of the biggest things is, like, you know, mites, and the other thing is regurgitation with boas. For some reason, it affects the digestive enzymes inside their stomach to the point where they can't keep anything down. I've heard of it affecting their nostrils, where their nostrils get plugged up, or, you know, with mucus, and you know, some symptoms might make you think, oh gosh, you know, it's got an RI, but, you know, it actually could be something else. From what I've been able to find out about it, there is no cure. Pretty much, you just have to put the animal down, and that's all there is to it. Because they haven't been able to figure out, you know, I mean, obviously it's coming from the wild somewhere, but they haven't been able to find out exactly where it's coming from, you know, the source, and how to treat it. I mean, really, there are no meds. There's nothing you can find to treat it. You have to put the animal down.
Right.
They know what it looks like under the microscope.
Well, there you go.
But, you know, but they don't know how to cure it, because they're
right.
You know, I don't know, but it's definitely pretty nasty, and you don't want to mess with it.
Right.
I think that you know, I don't think it goes unseen in pythons and boas. I think they both display the symptoms. I think boas will just last a little bit longer.
Oh, yeah.
But eventually they're going to croak, you know.
Right.
I mean, I think it shuts down the immune system of a python a lot quicker than it does a boa, but I haven't had any firsthand experience, so everything I'm talking about is based solely on what I've heard about IBD and, you know, the one case that I have heard of it happening with someone I actually knew personally who had a fairly large collection.
Right.
That person had no boas, so I couldn't speak of boas reacted. I just know that his pythons dropped like flies. I mean, literally, like, every day to every other day, every week, you know, he had animals just, you know, dying one after another.
Wow.
Jeez.
I mean,
I can't even.
It was like, it was like an, I mean, it was like something you, like an outbreak.
Right.
Like, he said it was so fast that he couldn't, like he notices it, you know, with one animal, and before he can really even start to, like, make adjustments in his reptile room, it's like one animal became three animals, and three animals became six animals. Before you know it, you know, half your collection's gone.
Right.
And, you know, you're not even, you haven't even been dealing with it for longer than, like, a month, you know, or a month and a half, and it just, I've heard it just affects pythons super quick.
Yeah, I've heard the same. They don't
yeah.
stand a chance. They're just there. They're dead. You know. So, huh? Okay. What about you, Dayton? Any thoughts on it?
So, I made sure I did my homework on this question. I didn't want to speculate, so I wanted to know, you know,
okay.
what to say, and I didn't want people to think that, you know, if you kept pythons, you couldn't have boas as well in your collection. So, IBD is a virus. So yes, it is transmitted through, like, mites can transmit it. It could be it could be airborne. It could be transmitted that way. If you're cleaning one cage and then you go clean another cage, it can be transmitted. You know, obviously from snake to snake if you're breathing. But, so, I think the main reason why most people think it's a boa thing is because I think when they discovered it, it's mainly a boa constrictor. In fact, I don't think I've heard of a case of it in tree boas.
Okay.
But in the pet, you know, hobby, it was boa constrictor, and people, you know, they were losing their collections because of this. And it can be asymptomatic, which means an animal can carry it and not show any signs of it. And those animals don't succumb to it. They don't die from it.
Right.
So symptomatic animals, it's always terminal. There is no treatment, and they will die. But it is found in both boas and pythons. I don't know if that's in the wild or if that's just because in captivity from people keeping, you know, a mixed collection. But it is both boas and pythons. Boas tend to carry it boas can carry it asymptomatically where pythons don't typically do that. So if you have a python with that disease, it will show it and it'll die from it more quickly than the boa would. I know there's more I want to talk about. Hold on a second. Gather my thoughts. I always get on one saying something and then I completely forget to talk about something else.
Right. Yeah. I know the feeling.
So until recently, the only way to test for IBD was to have a dead animal. The animal had to be dead. You had to test the brain and spinal tissue.
Right.
But recently, within like the past couple months, I believe, they now have a blood test where the animal doesn't have to die. You can test the blood, and it can tell you if that animal has IBD. So if you're having an outbreak in your collection, you can find out which animals have it, even if they're asymptomatic and they can be eliminated. That's the only way to get rid of it from your collection is to
gotcha.
Kill the animals that have it and hope that the healthy ones didn't catch it from something.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So that's what I know about IBD.
Okay. So you're saying that's good to know. Does it affect like the other boas, like say anacondas or the West Indian boas or anything like that? Have you heard of anything?
I would imagine that if you had you know, a boa constrictor that had it, and you had you know, a tree boa of some sort in your collection, it would be susceptible to that, just like it can transfer from boa to python.
Right.
But what I've heard of is IBD in boa constrictor, and I haven't heard of a case of it being with, you know, Amazon tree boas, emerald tree boas.
Okay. Man, scary stuff. Mm-hmm. Owen, do you have any thoughts on IBD, any experiences or anything?
I do not have any experiences, thank God. Oh, actually, I do. Years ago, though, before it was IBD, before it was just they called it stargazing with red tails, which, you know, is apparently one of the big things about IBD is that they all look up. So, yeah, that was one of those things. And I do know from working at the University of Pennsylvania that there is research being done on IBD at the University of Florida, as well as a few other labs, to try to figure out what it is, how it's caused, how to test for it, and how to kill it. So it is a scary mo right now, and there's really nothing we can do beyond good quarantine, good husbandry, and good practices. I do believe that it is going to be one of those things that someplace like the University of Florida will be able to tackle. The thing is that it's going to take a long time. It's not going to be a quick fix. This is something that is going to take a number of years, a lot of money, and it's going to take a while to trickle down to us as well. I mean, it's not going to be like they release the cure automatically for it. You know, this stuff takes a lot of time to get approval for, so... but yeah, it is terrifying to imagine that, you know, one day your entire collection is here, the next day it is gone. And I completely believe that mites are a vector for this, as well as many other things. I've heard of people who have certain respiratory infections, and then a mite outbreak comes, and all of a sudden the other snakes are showing signs of respiratory just because of mite will feed on one snake and then go to the next one. So, you know, mites are horrible, right, evil creatures that need to be burned from this planet, and I see no purpose to them on this world. I don't know why they're here. Them and mosquitoes, what are you here for? So, you know, it's one of those things. But,
gotcha.
But yeah, so definitely so, support research.
I'd like to add something.
I did too.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go for it.
So, this was a problem. I mean, it still is a problem, but it used to be more so. I think it's on the decline, and I am speculating on that, but I believe it's on the decline, and I don't really hear anything about it on all the forums that I'm a member of.
Right.
And it's not just, you know, if you're a boa guy, it's not just boa people that have to worry about this. It's
no.
Python people, boa people.
Everybody, yeah.
And it's something that can be easily spread because it's a virus. So it could be spread at, you know, expos, you know, reptile shows. If you, you know, aren't washing your hands, or you're touching animals, or someone else is touching animals and then touching your animals. So what Owen said about, you know, proper quarantine and just being careful is the best way to go about bringing anything negative into your collection, really.
Yeah.
I think it goes undiagnosed, to be honest. I think it's very prominent with emeralds. You hear of lots of emerald guys having their animals just regurging, like, time and time again, and they can't figure out why. And I think sometimes, maybe not every time, but I do think that there's a lot of cases where it could be that, and, you know, that may be the very, very reason why your animal's not keeping anything down, or why it's lethargic or whatnot, you know, because, you know, it's just going undiagnosed. I've even heard of guys with ball pythons having the same issue where their ball python will not, like, keep anything down to save its life, you know, and eventually the animal, you know, dies. So
I had heard about it because when I was working at the zoo, we had 3 Amazon basin emerald tree boas. And I was always told that they needed small meals and needed to be fed at night. Otherwise, they would get something which is called chronic regurgitation disease, where it was going to do nothing but puke in until it died. And now, of course, we know more about IBD as well as other things, that one of the main things is that it's just going to keep throwing up. Do you think that, and I like your theory of that this is just undiagnosed stuff. I mean, it could have been, but everybody just called it what they thought it was. I mean, I had a California king snake that ended up getting Giardia, and it inflamed his intestines so much he couldn't keep food down. He just kept throwing it back up. I used to have to give him rat pups because those would dissolve fast enough in his stomach that he could actually eat something until the Giardia got kicked. So,
in emeralds, I'm not saying that there could be undiagnosed cases of IBD, but there is regurgitation syndrome, which is caused by bacteria, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be a separate issue.
Okay.
You'd have to figure out the other symptoms and to be able to, you know, if regurgitation is the only symptom, then it probably would be the regurgitation syndrome.
Got it.
But if it is stargazing and, you know, having neurological issues, that might be IBD as well.
Well, other thing. Right.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, now that we're all depressed.
Yeah, now that we all really want to just bathe in bleach before we look at our snakes again, yeah.
Let's move on. All right, so these are some one-hitters. we'll start with you, Jeff. What's your next big purchase?
A house? I don't know. Are we talking about snakes or
snakes?
I got to do the house thing, yeah.
Who needs a house?
Yeah.
Come on, I do.
Man.
As far as snakes go, I mean, I didn't know if you guys were talking about cages or snakes, but
give
for snakes, well, I'd really like to, my next big purchase is either going to be some red Amazon blood. I'd like to get some red, get my hands on some red Amazon tree boas, which are pretty pricey in the Amazon world. I mean, it's kind of, you know, definitely the supply is less than the demand, and the people that do produce them pretty much hold on to most of them. It's either going to be that or a pair of diamond pythons. So,
diamond. Yes.
I'm not sure. I'd really like to get some Moluccan scrub pythons, but I'm just not set up to house any adults or sub adults, and that's what I see readily available, so I kind of want to stick to my projects, and diamond pythons have been a favorite of mine for a long time. So it would be some red Amazons or some diamond pythons, I think.
Okay. How about you, Dayton?
I'm pretty happy with my collection right now. I have, for the most part, all the tree boas that I want and tree pythons. And I want to keep my collection that way, just tree boas and tree pythons. But my next big purchase will probably be in about a year or so. I'm going to work on Well, I'm currently working on getting a bloodline from Europe of Amazon tree boas, and I'm working on importing those.
Oh wow!
Here
Very
to
cool.
the U.S. Yeah.
Cool. All right. How many? Is there like a specific a number of bloodlines, or is it, you know?
It's just one bloodline, and I'm planning on buying the whole litter.
Oh, there you go. All right.
The hypothetical litter at this point. So.
You're doing it. You're doing it citrus tiger style. That's what I call it.
Oh, buy everything so Owen gets pissed. Yeah, exactly. Citrus tiger style.
How about you, Owen? Well, let me guess.
Go ahead. Give it to me. Give it to me. Come on. What is it?
Rough scales?
Maybe. I don't know. I want them so bad. But there's that whole thing of tannin bars. Yeah, those would be nice. The problem is I can't. This whole thing of like, Owen, you need a place to live, and you need this house. And those houses come with closing costs and, you know, insurance and all that other shit. Maybe we shouldn't buy pythons at the moment. And then people are like, hey, Owen, what about this rough scale? I'm like, all of you, go to hell. So it's, at the moment, I want to say nothing, but I know something's going to come up, and I know something's going to be beating me upside the head. Like, tomorrow there's going to be some guy going, I don't want my rough scales anymore, $800 for all four of them. And then I'm going to have to do that. So... I don't know. That's why I'm trying to do a lot of trades where I'm like, take these and give me that, and everyone's happy. So, but you only trade so much.
Right.
Oh, I don't want to cut anybody off, but I've been doing a lot of trading recently, and it's worked out freaking awesome.
I do enjoy it when it works. I do.
Oh, man.
I do, because then it's like, oh, this super caramel has been pissing me off and eats everything, can go away, and I can get stuff that I want, and it's okay. I haven't gained, I haven't lost, gained, everything's fine. So I definitely love trading.
Yeah, that's a cool way to go if you can work it out, no doubt.
Yeah.
You can get some cool stuff. I actually got one of the nicest red tigers you could possibly imagine for trading a chondro. And I think it worked out well for me. I don't know how Zach feels.
Didn't that chondro turn out to be a boy?
No. That's the.
That wasn't the one. Okay.
No.
Because I would have strangled you. I mean, I'm just saying. You know, trade a prize red tiger for an opposed female, and it turns out to be a boy. Someone's getting beat up with a sock full of quarters. So.
Oh my God, Owen. My next big purchase, well, I'll throw a little plug out there for Mr. Paul Harris. He does an importation every year of stuff from UK Pythons, and it goes over to Nick, and then he distributes out through the U.S., so I guess, I don't know if it's closed yet or not, but I know it's coming pretty close, so if you're looking at something carpet python wise that you want to get, I'd go check out his site and then get in contact with either Paul or Nick and hook it up. But anyway, I guess the next big purchase, there's one I can't talk about, and then there's one I can talk about. It's an Exanic Zebra. That's my next big one. Yeah. So...
That won't be a pure jungle, right?
No.
They don't have Xantic pure jungles, right?
They do in Australia, yeah.
Oh, okay.
But the one I will have will not be, no.
No, it will be a mix. It'll be a mud.
Yeah.
Intergrade.
Well, I think coastals and jungles are the same, so I don't look at it that way. But most people do, so it is what it is. You know what I mean?
On a genetic level, I'd probably agree with you. Yeah.
Did you memorize that passage from the Complete Carpet Python the second you read it? You're just like, oh my God, and you keep reading it until you had it down. Okay.
Actually, when when Nick was writing the book, he contacted me. He started talking to me about it, and I was like, "Oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever!" I wanted to tell everybody, but I couldn't. You know, it's like
you had to keep it quiet. Yeah, yeah.
It didn't catch on. It didn't catch on like I thought it would. You know what I mean? Like, it's just the same thing genetically, so we're just going to breed them together, and who cares? But what are you going to do?
I still don't know what the hell I'm supposed to call my scrubs, like, or my white lips. Nomenclature wise, I haven't learned it. I don't care. So I'll get there eventually.
Yeah. Okay. Next one would be racks or cages. What are you, Jeff? Rack or cage?
Oh, I'm at war with myself on this one because I just traded some big spacious cages for a rack. I'm a firm believer that cages are the best way to go. The house I'm living in is I just don't have a lot of room, and I'm not going to be here but maybe another year to a year and a half. So instead of getting rid of my animals, which I did one time and regretted it, I've decided to just put them in smaller, you know, in a big rack system and I'm not going to be pounding them full of food, but, you know, try and keep them a little leaner and slow the growth down a little bit. And, once I move into my bigger house, then I have the rack and, you know, I use it for whatever, but, I like cages better. I like being able to see my snakes. I like a little bit of height. I like to put perches in there for, you know, then drape across and climb on and everything like that. But over next year, I'm going to be, you know, going just racks. So I don't really know how that fits into your question, but
right.
I prefer cages,
opinion.
But I use racks. So for the time being.
Gotcha. How about you, Dayton? Racks or cages?
So I use racks and cages. I got four different types of cages for my adults. But I use racks for neonates and yearlings. I that's the only way you got to go with that.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to have 100 different little cages for little snakes.
Right.
But I know Rico Walder has some really nifty adult racks, and those cost him a pretty penny. But as my collection continues to grow, and it will, probably have to end up, you know, getting some sort of rack system for my adults as well.
Gotcha. Okay. Owen?
Racks and cages. And I have racks that can actually support adult carpets, in my opinion, but I still prefer them to be in the cages just from the same reasons of it gives them a little bit more space, and it allows me to see them and see what's going on. Normally, the way I do it is if it's a female, it gets a cage automatically when it becomes an adult, just because more space, more room, more everything. Also, the males go to the female cages during breeding, so, you know, a 4 or 5 foot boy can hang out in a 41 quart tub and be completely happy. When, you know, we get to my girls who are 6, 7 feet, they can't really go into the tubs, so they get cages.
We totally neglect our males in captivity. Besides offering them
apparently
all the females that they can have, they really
right
get the short end of the stick.
I know. It's terrible.
They don't get fed.
The,
they get crammed into a tiny box.
Well,
it's like, what the hell, man?
It was funny because Eric came over Sunday, and he's looking at one of the snakes that I produced, which is a brother to a baby he got from me. And he's like, is that the Hycon? I'm like, yeah. He's like, is that the brother to mine? I go, yeah. And he goes, God, I suck. Oh, my God. It's so much bigger than the one I have. I'm like, oh, it's different things. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we obviously neglect and abuse our poor animals.
Yeah, it's a – I don't know. I'm learning a lot about, like, feeding and what I – like, I don't know. I go through
these things where I hear something and I try to adapt it and it doesn't necessarily work out the way that I thought it does. But on the opposite, Owen and me are kind of opposites in as far as we've kind of met in the middle as of recent, you know, but when we first started the show and everything, he fed, you know, every week, you know, big meals, that kind of thing. I fed, you know,
yep,
maybe once a month, smaller meals. You know, it was just, I don't know. So that's where you, but you can see the huge difference. And I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I guess I need to take better care of my snakes. I don't know what I'm doing here or whatever, but
God,
whatever.
I'm abusing them. I mean, yeah. But it was different ways. And it was things in the important thing is that you got clutches, I got clutches. Well, they're two varying different things, and it's not like the environment was too much to blame. We don't live, like, what, 10 minutes apart? So
yeah, exactly.
It's okay.
Yeah.
So,
I'm a rack guy, I guess. I mean, yeah, I think I like cages. I like the whole, like, you can see what they're doing and everything. But to be honest, sometimes I think that racks are better for the snakes because they are not annoyed by us staring in their cages all the time and stressing them out. That could apply to, like, maybe I'm thinking, like, scrub-wise. I just see that my scrubs do better in racks than they do in cages. I don't know what your thoughts on that, Owen, are, but
well,
that's what mine do.
Our baby scrubs do great in tubs and racks. They have no problems in that. As they get older, they do enjoy, you know, having the cages because we, of course, do it up with the perches. And we also try to give them as many hide areas as we can in a cage. And in a cage, you can give them more. You can give them ones that are higher, lower, medium. It's a bunch of stuff. And the same thing goes with the white lips. We can do more in the cage because of, you know, we can put the deep substrate. We can give them those burrows. It's just a little bit better for them to be in cages. Can you do it in a adult drawer rack system like Freedom Breeder? Probably. But, you know, we're not going to be the first ones to try it. So.
All right, fair enough. All right, reptile vendor or reptile show attendee? Which are you, Jeff?
I've never vended. I've been to a lot of shows, so I'd like to vent and try that out and see how that is.
Right. Okay. How about you, Dayton? Do you prefer
vendor?
Vendor. Okay.
Yeah, and I've been to local shows. Honestly, though, I don't sell too much. I'm not very in your face. Hey, how's it going? I'm not much of a salesman. If you know what I'm selling, then, you know, you'll like my prices and you'll be happy with the product. But if you ask me what it is, I'm going to sell it to you.
Okay.
And the most commonly asked question is, does it bite? And, then they instantly turn away. But
move along.
Next.
Right. They're like, ooh, that's pretty. Does it bite? Yeah, it does. Okay, move along, kid. Yeah, but
that's awesome.
I know Nick and a couple local guys, so I like to, you know, go before the show and hang out with them a bit and stuff. So.
Well, we know where we fall, Owen. You're a vendor, and I'm a vendee.
I am a vendor. Sometimes I bring someone else's stuff and sell all of it at shows and not a single one of my own. Right?
Yeah, that works out well for me. I don't know.
It
well, you know?
Works great for the other guy. Of course it does. I'm about ready to throw something at it, but yeah, no. It works great for him, me
Jeff,
being the vendor.
Jeff,
anyway.
Jeff, you should see if you can hook up the same kind of deal that I hooked up with Owen, you know, like being host and co-host type thing that, you
yeah,
know, you can...
Yeah. Abusive relationship.
I give you all my snakes, and you just go and take them and sell them, and yeah, okay. And I'll see you tomorrow and just collect the money, and we'll call it good.
I get a nice pat on the head. Yeah, I get a nice pat on the head.
Good job,
Owen.
I want us to get a Corrales radio booth here at the Sacramento show. It's pretty big, so.
There you go.
We had one at ICAS, and that worked out well for the most part. But, you know, apparently someone takes offense when I try to sell off his entire collection when he's not at the table. So, you know, it's one of those things that you have to avoid. Yeah. But I very much like doing shows, especially now that I'm meeting all the people and in or around. And it's fun because I've gotten hookups for animals that I would have completely missed because of my relationship with other vendors at shows. I mean, I got my water python because right before a show, one of the guys there is like, hey, you've been looking for this, right? And I'm like, yes. And I scooped it up. Shows are just fun because it's also the education of the public. What you're saying with, like, does it bite? My favorite response is five-year-old kids bite. So, I mean, this thing, everything bites. It's got teeth, it bites. And, of course, educating the children while their parents are behind them going, it's going to kill everything you ever loved. And it goes, what? No. So, you know, it's fun to do that. And it's good to get out with the scaly kids. So, I definitely enjoy shows. There are certain ones, though, where I refuse to do it just because they're, A, not worth me bringing all the animals down there just to have nothing sell. And B, I don't like the feel I get when I walk in the door. It feels like stuff's crawling on me. So, yeah, I just don't want to do those shows. So, but, yeah, I think shows are nice.
Okay. I'm gonna ask these two questions, and then we'll move on to some Corrales talk. If you could travel anywhere in the world with no limitations, where would you go and why? Go ahead, Jeff.
I've got three different places. First would be Costa Rica. I just want to go down there and pretty much live in the rainforest for a week or so, and just see whatever I can find.
All right, good time.
And then the second and third would be Australia or islands of Indonesia. I just those are the two places that I really, really enjoy. Or the species that I really enjoy come from those places. So, I'd like to go to Africa too, but, for the most part, if I could just pick one, like right now to go, and visit, probably, Costa Rica, I think.
Okay. What about you, Dayton?
I would choose Australia. Steve Irwin was a big, he was like my hero growing up. And just the number of different reptiles they have there has got to be unmatched. And I think it'd be really cool to see a huge saltwater crocodile chilling on a riverbank.
That would be pretty badass. I would agree. How about you, Owen?
Well, you know, obviously Oz, just because, you know, I want to be that idiot in the tour group that runs at the carpet python going, oh, my God, it's amazing, as everyone else is like, what? We see those every Tuesday. So, I mean, you know, that I want to do. I mean, of course, the other ones are, you know, Papua New Guinea for the exact same reason, and I wouldn't mind doing places like India or Africa just to see some of the other different types of reptile. Madagascar, I think, would be really badass, especially with the different jungles and stuff. Basically, I just want to go to a place where I can wander around with my snake hook and not get any cell phone reception and then turn up 2 weeks later and text everybody that I didn't die in the jungle. It's okay. and then come back to the United States. So that I would have way too much fun. So.
Right. Yeah, I guess I would be the same. I'm kind of in Dayton's camp. Australia is kind of the mecca for me as far as reptiles go.
Steve Irwin being down there. I'd love to go to the Australia Zoo. I'd love to go to like Bob Irwin's his place and get to meet him. And Papua New Guinea would probably be the next. And then I'd like to go find a Burmese python in the wild where it's supposed to be. I think that would be
I found a Burmese python in Florida. No, Eric, no, it's not where it's supposed to be.
No. I want to find it where it's supposed to be. And then I guess here it would be, this is a two banger. What is, in your opinion, what is the best species, subspecies of Morelia and Corallis? Go ahead, Jeff.
Corallis, Hortulanus, but if I could get my hands on Grenadensis, then I probably would start to lean towards them over Hortulanus, but we can't get Grenadensis, so Hortulanus it is, which are the Amazon tree boas. And as far as Morelia goes, ouch, man, that's hard because I want to say Bradley or Cheney. Like, I don't know which which I would choose, but
okay.
Jungles and Brettles pythons have always, you know, intrigued me.
Gotcha.
So.
Okay. How about you, Dayton?
I'm a little biased. So with Corallis, it's Hortulanus, definitely. I mean, just a natural color variation. That you get the earth tones as well as, you know, when are you going to see a bright red or yellow or orange, you know, snake in the wild? And that's natural color. That happens in the wild. They still import snakes that look like that. So that's just, I don't know, really awesome to me.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you got the emerald tree boa, but to me, there's a lot of different green snakes that are really bright and vivid green.
Right.
So.
Okay.
And then Morelia, it would be Viridis, so the green
okay.
python.
Gotcha.
And that would be because I just like the sort of like captive history with it and how, you know, some of the snakes you get have, well, they're musts, but you get, you know, a pedigree going back to the 70s, and that's just, I mean, I think it's really cool that
yeah.
people have put that time and energy into, you know, to doing something like that.
Heck yeah, all the way from the beginning. Yeah. What about you, Owen?
Corallis is Amazon tree boa all the way. Oh, my gentle lord. I mean, the colors and just the way that they act, they're so cool, and they have an attitude which just kind of, it just appeals to me. And, you know, Julie had brought hers to ICAST, and I was kind of drooling over theirs, and she was talking about them, and I'm like, God damn it, it's another one I'm going to have to add to the freaking list eventually to get. So those would definitely be what I would consider cool. Out of Morelia, I'm just going to have to say, out of the ones that I love, is I got to go with Coastal. They are, and always have been, my bread and butter and my babies. So, you know, I like it that they get big, and they got the big, thick head, and just the cool patterns and the colors. I don't know, we have discussed this, Eric, about, you know, how everyone does the line and lineage breeding when it comes to IJ or jungle first and now IJ more, and you almost want to consider what could happen with coastals as well. You mean you've seen the red project, so I coastals, always coastals. So
Morelia would be for me would be IJs, obviously. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
I think Inlands would be the next one after that. But
I forgot those.
Yeah, they're badass. And I guess as far as Corallis, I think there's two that stick out to me. I really like the Annulateds, and I like the Russian Burger Eye. That would be the two there, you know. I've never kept either one of them, but I'm just going solely on looks and what would attract me to them. So, with that being said, let's get some let's cram some Corrales talk in here with Corrales, like a 101 type of thing. What is the species overview? What is available, and what you know, is the complex made up of?
Are we still doing round table style, or is this just like fair
game?
No,
this is you guys. Go for it.
Yeah, I can't contribute. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Corrales time now, so let's break
yes.
it down.
Well, I can talk a little bit about that, unless you want to go, Dayton.
It doesn't matter to me. I'm a little confused to how this is going to work, but we just take turns answering the questions, or
yeah, just go for it. I mean, you know, I don't know which one of you is, you know, like with Owen and me, there's certain ones that are more versed in things than other things. You know, I don't. So maybe you go with the natural history. Jeff, and maybe we keep it and breed him. Why don't you go, Dayton? Sound good?
Okay, sounds good.
All right.
Well,
so go for it, Jeff.
There's eight different species of Corrales. You've obviously got the emeralds, the northern emerald tree boas, and the Amazon basin emerald tree boas. You have the Russian Burger Eye, or the Central American tree boas. You've got Hortulanus, or the Amazon tree boas. You've got Crepani, which are the southernmost species of Corrales, which is down in, like, southern Brazil. They can tolerate super cold temperature. Well, super cold for a python or boa, like 40s.
Right.
And they're not extinct, but they're extremely rare. And I don't think... they're pretty elusive. Let's put it that way. They may not be that rare, but there's just not a lot of pictures of them, of live specimens, at least. You've got the annulated tree boas, which are probably the most docile of the Corrales genus. They come in the really cool colors that you see with the Russian Burger Eye and the Amazons, but they don't have quite the color palette. They have a garden phase, or a garden color, which in my opinion is much prettier pattern-wise and color-wise than the gardens that you see with Amazons, because theirs are kind of range from almost like a gray to like a brown tan color. And then you have orange. The other color that they come in is orange. Some a little, you know, a little red tinge to them, but let's see, who am I forgetting? I know I'm forgetting somebody. Forgetting one of the species. I can't remember which one. We've got annulated Amazons, Crepani, Russian Burger Eye.
Cook-eye?
Huh?
Cook-eye? Cooks?
Cooks, yeah. Cook-eye and Grenadian tree boas.
Okay.
So the Cook-eye look a lot like the Amazons, and I think that they were probably imported into the country, you know, years ago, but, you know, we can't get them anymore. And then the Grenadian tree boas, which look a lot like the Amazons, but they have a different pattern to them, and they come in different color, a little bit different, like, color pattern.
Okay.
I think this, to people that aren't very well versed in Grenadian tree boas, or in tree boas or Corrales in general, they might think that an Amazon, a Cook's, and Grenadian tree boa all, you know, are the same species. But to someone who, you know, knows their Corrales, you can look and tell differences in pattern, color, and size, and scale count around the head. You know, I think that they are just the Morelia of boas, real, or of the Morelia boas, because they come in so many different, you know, color palettes and different sizes, and the difference is there's just not very many people keeping them, and that's partially due to the fact that the only ones that are kept in any real numbers here in the U.S. are Hortolanus, and then emeralds and basins. There are people that are starting to work with Rischenberger eye, and there are some people that are starting to work with annulated, but, you know, Cook's eye and Grenadensis and Grappani, I mean, you're not gonna see those here in the U.S. I mean, probably the closest we'll ever get to is seeing them in a book, and that probably has to do mostly with, you know, import-export limitations and whatnot.
Gotcha.
You know, we did an episode with Nick Mutton a month and a half. Actually, it was the first show of 2014, and he talked a little bit about the divergence of species as far as Corallis goes, and it was pretty interesting, you know. You know, these animals have, you know, evolved in a really cool way. I mean, as far as, you know, their colors and things. I mean, the Amazons, and I mean, they're pretty much an arboreal species. You're not going to see them on the ground, really. I mean, they'll be to the ground. And some instances you'll see them super high in the trees, but you know they're not going to be crawling around, and they pretty much can live in up in the treetops, and they can have all of their basic needs met up in the trees. I mean, they really don't need to come down on the ground for anything.
Gotcha.
I mean, and that's going for all species of. In the Corallis genus. I mean, pretty much all of their needs can be met up in the trees. The jungle's so dense that, you know, I mean, they either look like a flower or blend in just fine. So, I don't know if there are some other things a little more specific that you wanted me to hit on, but, you know, I just think they're badass in every shape or way. I think that people are scared of them. They think all they do is bite, but they're kind of pretty to look at, and that's just not the case. You know, I have some Amazons in my collection right now that have never struck at me. I can go in and free handle them as much as I want, and they eat whenever I offer them food, so they're not sick.
Right.
But they don't strike at me. You know,
right.
They don't try and bite me, and I think it's all in how you handle them. You go in there with your hands shaking and you're all super nervous and, you know, you're, you know, timid and going in and grabbing them and whatnot, yeah, I think you're going to get tagged. But I think if you go in there slow and you, you know, you handle them in a way that's not a threat and you're confident, you know, I don't think you really have anything to worry about.
Gotcha. Okay. I think we hit on most of the stuff as far as natural history and such. I mean, you're saying that I guess the most common one is the do they mix them up? Is that something that they do, or do you get chastised and tarred and feathered if you do something like that?
Well, I might tar and feather you because I'm not a big fan of it, but there hasn't been any known hybridizing in Corallis that we know of, you know,
okay.
So far. There were some hybrids that came in, but those animals never proved out. I think that probably there probably was a little bit of hybridizing between the Cook eye and the Hortolanus back, you know, in the, you know, elder years of breeding them, and probably went, you know, to an untrained eye that thought he had two different color Amazons and just put them together.
Sure.
So, you know, there's no way to know for sure, but you know, I forgot to mention that these animals also range from, you know, Costa Rica, Guatemala, you know, Ecuador, all the way down through Peru, the Amazon basin of Brazil, and all the way down into southern Brazil, which is where Crapani lives. I don't think I touched on the range, but pretty much, you know, below Mexico, Central America, you know, Guatemala,
right,
those places. And then you have some stretching out into the Cook Islands and the islands of Trinidad the Grenadian Islands. I think that's how it is.
Okay.
The only time I ever use the word is whenever I'm saying Grenadensis.
The islands of Grenada.
Grenada, right.
There you go.
So
I wanted to add a little bit to the hybrid. There have been hybrid emeralds and Amazons.
Okay.
No one's done it in captivity. They were imported, and all of them, there have been a couple different litters, I think. All of them were from imported female emeralds. I know Danny Mendez had probably some of the, from an earlier clutch in the maybe 90s or early 2000 or something like that. I don't know. I believe Rolf Kern had at least one or a few of them that he was working with to try to get F2 animals.
Okay.
But for the most part, it has been shunned. It's a little different than, you know, crossing the green tree pythons because they're all the same species right now.
I'm glad you added the right now part.
Yeah, right now. But with tree boas, they are different species, so it would be more like mixing it'd be a carpondro, basically.
Gotcha.
Right.
A carp python mixed with a green tree python. So yeah, that's pretty shunned in that community as well. It's just not good. I don't think so, anyway.
Right. Okay. Then maybe we'll hit on some keeping part of it. So you're saying that these guys are spending most of the life in trees and whatnot. What's the basic setup for these guys? I'm thinking for babies, and then does it change for adults? Obviously, earlier we were talking about racks versus cages, and you're moving it up when they become adults. So what, like, give me size-wise, what kind of temps, what kind of lights, substrate, perches, et cetera. Like, what are you doing to set these guys up?
All right. So I guess we'll start with perches. So with chondros, you get the, you know, the basic horizontal perch. It's just a rod. They like to drape themselves over it. It's a bit different with the Amazon tree boas. They like to sort of, they don't like to drape over something. They like to find a good resting spot that they can rest their whole body on. So thicker branches with crossing, you know, you want them to overlap and make, I guess they call it the 3 points of contact. So the snake has 3 points of contact as opposed to the 2 points.
Gotcha. Right.
Right. So I use grapevine, manzanita. I screw it together in different ways to make perches for my tree boas, and that would be with the adults. With the yearlings and neonates, I use a wire mesh, and it's basically, you get it at Home Depot, it's some kind of like plastic fencing. That you would see in a garden, and you just cut a little square and fold it into the box, and it sort of makes an arch. And,
oh, yeah, yeah,
they
yeah.
Like to, you know what I'm talking about, yeah?
Yep, absolutely.
And so that way they can lay their whole body on it, and they're not draped over anything. I've also used coat hangers, but I make it into a square so they get corners to sit in as opposed to hanging in the middle. And they both perch readily on that.
Okay.
As far as temperature goes, tree boas kind of, I know there's the whole thought that all reptiles need a certain temperature and it's all similar. But tree boas like it kind of cooler. I do keep my green tree pythons the same way. My daytime highs are around 84 to 86 or 7-ish. And year-round, I have that daytime high. And year-round, I have a nighttime drop of about, it gets down to like mid-70s. And I do that year-round. And that's both with, you know, juveniles and adults.
Okay.
As far as misting or humidity, a lot of people are backing off the misting of the chondros because of, like, respiratory problems.
Right.
Even I've backed off the misting of the chondros, and that seems to be fine. But I noticed with my tree boas, maybe their skin is a little thicker. When a green tree python sheds, even if it's patterned or is speckled, the shed is completely see-through. You don't see any of that pattern on the shed.
Okay.
But when my tree boa is shed, it seems like you get clear shed, and you also get pattern. You can see what pattern the snake has. I don't know if that has to do with the thickness or not. But I think they have thicker skin, and they seem to need more humidity. I don't know. I missed every day or three. So sometimes I'll miss every day. Sometimes I miss, you know, once every 3 days. But
I was just going to say, I'm lucky if I hit twice a week on my misting.
Oh, okay. In the tubs, it's easier to, you know, maintain humidity, definitely.
Right.
Especially in not heated tubs or plastic cages.
Right.
But I do have exoterras as well.
Okay.
I just miss my tree boas more frequently, and I get better shed. You know, I get good sheds from them. It's a lot. I can neglect my chondros a lot more in that sense and still get a perfect shed.
Right.
Gotcha.
Now, do you notice any respiratory infections in the tree boas like you would in the tree pythons? Is that the same type of thing? Or it's
yes.
Not? Oh, it is. Okay.
You do get respiratory infections in tree boas sometimes. I've gotten animals with respiratory infections and never been able to get rid of them. So, I've tried multiple different medications. Eventually, the animal died. Then I've had a gravid female develop signs of an RI. And because she was gravid, I didn't treat her with any kind of medication until after she had given birth, and she ended up dying from
what I would
assume is a respiratory infection.
So. Gotcha.
They do get it, but I think overall they're less sensitive than green tree pythons. In my experience, they haven't developed an RI for no reason. Well, neither have my green tree pythons, but I do know people that keep large collections of green tree pythons, and they get very frustrated with their collection. Animals getting sick for apparently no reason, you know, things like that. So,
right,
they are a pretty hardy snake.
Okay,
that's good.
What about lights?
Go ahead.
Do you do anything? Do you do anything with lights or anything like that?
No, all my lights are just natural from the window.
Okay.
Or room light, but that's just when I'm in the room.
Gotcha.
And I noticed you did send the outline of the show, and you talked. You were going to ask the importance of UV or something.
Right. Yep.
I wanted to touch a little bit on that.
Sure. Go ahead.
Both species I keep with the Amazon tree boa and the green tree python are primarily nocturnal, so I don't think it plays a role at all, really.
Okay.
Them being active at night, I don't think it, I don't think it'll, affect them negatively not having UV. I'm sure they're, hiding or perched in the daytime, and at night they're active. Yeah, unless, it's a gravid female that's basking, but you can provide a heat source that doesn't have UV or UVA
right.
or UVB or whatever. So
right.
I don't think it's critical. Maybe if you're keeping, like, a desert lizard species, I do think that they do need their light spectrum to be healthy.
Okay. So what about a substrate? What are you using for a substrate? Are you using like a mulch type of thing, or are you using just paper?
I'm using paper towels. I've used paper towels. I've used newspaper. Didn't like newspaper. It stained the bottom of my cages.
Right.
Now they're stained, though, so I have white cages, I guess. I don't have black cages, so. Don't use newspaper and white cages if you don't want the bottom stained.
There you go. Good tip.
I guess I could use newspaper now anyway, but then I get, ink rubs off on the animals, and that bugs me. I look at it and wonder if that's ink or if that's something else. So I use paper towels. I have used cypress mulch in the past and cocoa fiber. Both have worked pretty well. Both hold humidity. Neither mold. And with the mulch, you can spot clean, so you don't have to just, take everything out of the cage and take the snake out, and, spray it down with cleaner and lay new paper towels. It's a long process with a big collection.
Gotcha.
But I do use paper, and it just looks clean, and I can see everything, and I like it that way.
Okay. What about as far as feeding? Are you feeding them a specific thing? I know in chondros, mice, some people say don't feed rats, and how often? Because these guys are pretty lean, from what I observe. But what's your thoughts with that?
Yeah, so... I don't necessarily agree that you should only feed a chondro mice. Not that I'm a, chondro expert or anything. But I think both mice and rats provide a little bit of a, it's a varied diet, and they also are better for different things. If you're feeding, like a weanling rat as compared to a jumbo mouse, I believe that the weanling rat's going to have a higher fat content, and the adult mouse is going to be higher in calcium. So depending on what you're wanting to put into your snake, you could feed a different prey item, and you shouldn't have a problem. Your chondro is not going to prolapse just because you feed it rats. That's not going to happen. If you overfeed it rats, that might make it prolapse. But at the moment, because I've been weirded out by different mice places, I've had not satisfactory service, I I get mice from a local guy, and he only breeds mice. So I only feed mice at the moment. Before I get into that, I wanted to say you're not going to overfeed your Amazon tree boa. That's not going to happen. They have an extremely fast metabolism. They're like a colubrid. Sometimes I clean cages twice a week. It's a pain in the ass. But it's just, in one end, out the other. I've never heard of an Amazon having a prolapse. So whether you're feeding mice or rats, you can feed them fairly often, on a schedule of once a week if you'd like. I feed kind of randomly between, once a week and once every 3 weeks, depending on the snake. I don't feed my whole collection at one time. I'll thaw out just because it's such a pain to, I don't know. I've seen people do it quicker than I do, but I thaw out mice. Thawing out 60, 70 mice takes a while for me. And then I gotta, go through all the cages and feed all the snakes. So I don't like doing that. I'll thaw out, 15 at a time or so. I'm getting closer to, starting to pair things up. I do like to feed the females, say like once a week. So on a more tighter schedule, I guess. Once a week, I try to feed the females before breeding, just so they have some good fat reserves, because the females do go off feed sometimes. And then I do like to keep it pretty regular with the feedings on my neonates up until, they're a yearling or so. And those you can feed, every 4 days if you like.
Now, would you consider a bird diet for some of your corrals? I mean, I feed chicken to some of our scrubs every once in a while.
I wouldn't have any problem with it, except for birds are pretty closely related to reptiles. And so there are some things that can be passed pretty easily from bird to reptile. I wouldn't have a problem, maybe throwing a bird in there every once in a while. They are, I think, a little harder to digest.
Okay.
But, maybe not with the, a chick or something with a down, but,
quail and the stuff with feathers, right?
Yeah. And, I've heard at shows people telling me, I've kind of snooped and, hear people talking, I've never understood why people feed tree snakes, mice. That doesn't make any sense. Well, I'm going to quote but my information from the Neotropical Tree Boas by Dr. Robert Henderson. In his studies, he found he would always search at night, so he always found his corallis down in, low-hanging tree limbs and bushes, down near the floor, because they primarily hunt mammals. They hunt rats. They hunt mice. So that is their natural diet. They're not mainly hunting birds. The babies, though, I believe he mainly found, little geckos and things in their diet. But, so adult tree boas, their natural food would be mammalian and not birds. As far as, Amazon tree boas, Grenadian tree boas, cooks, things like that. Not so sure about emerald tree boas, but
okay. So, no, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and I've heard some people have a hard time getting their neonates to start. I've had no trouble. I start them on frozen thawed pinks. I usually get like one troublesome feeder in a litter, and even then, it doesn't come down to force feeding. It's just a waiting game.
Then that the waiting game is what sucks. You can wait for a while.
Yeah,
but that's always a good one. So, so they definitely are seasonal feeders when it comes to certain things like that.
No,
just feed year round, kind of.
If you're talking about a seasonal feeder, like I feed my females a little bit more before I pair them up. Yeah.
Okay, but you don't stop food altogether.
Yes, and I don't have males that go off feed.
Okay, then. Okay, I got you now. Makes sense.
My males will always eat tree boas. My chondro males will. Some of them will go off feed, which is pretty common.
When they get close to the breeding, time, right? Yeah. Yeah, I tend not to freak out if my guys go off food towards breeding. What is the biggest misconception that you guys can think about Corrales?
Well, I actually need to get going, but I'll just go ahead and chime in on this real quick.
Good.
I just think people think that they're overly aggressive, and that you know they bite a lot and they're just super mean. That seems to be what I've heard the most from everybody. I mean, I've talked to people a lot of times about them before, and the same thing I get out of everyone is, don't those bite a lot?
Right.
And it's kind of like, well, you know, like you were saying, everything bites. It's just a matter of how you approach it.
Right.
You know, you just got to learn how the species works and stay within those tolerances. So.
Gotcha.
I don't know. That's my opinion of the biggest misconception.
Yeah, I want to touch a little bit on that. So I guess I'm going to kind of disagree a little bit with Jeff here on this one. I'm not saying that there aren't tree boas that don't bite. Jeff has a tree boa from me, and it's never bit him. It's never bit me, and I had it, you know, a year or so before I sent it to him. I've got siblings from that snake that don't bite me. But I just think it's downplayed. I mean, yes, you want to attract people to the species of snake that you keep, but you don't want to mislead them. This species of snake, for the most part, is a pretty aggressive species. Most of them will bite you, even if they're not in your face about it. I was hand shedding my hypo the other day because it had a stuck shed on it, and I was messing around with him. I didn't hold his head or anything, and he wasn't biting me, and I was messing with him a bit more, and he moved his head towards my hand, and he kind of looked at me for a second, and then he bit me. It's like he was like, do I want to bite you? Okay, yeah, I'm going to bite you. So
that was nice of him.
right, yeah. Some definitely are more aggressive than others. But it's not a corn snake. It's a ball python. And most baby snakes are aggressive.
True.
Amazon tree boa adults, they'll still take a shot at you. And some of it has to do with how you handle them. There are certain ways that you can handle them that don't don't what's the word I'm thinking of? They don't elicit as an aggressive response from the tree boa as if you were to handle it more aggressively.
Okay.
If it thinks you're a predator, it's going to bite you. If it thinks it needs to bite you to survive, it's going to do that.
Okay.
But you also have to remember these animals have, you know, heat pits, and you're hot. You're a mammal. So, that's something else that can elicit a strike from them, you know.
Gotcha.
Hey, guys.
Because they got good teeth. Oh.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's okay.
I was going to say I need to bow out, so I appreciate you guys having me on. I'll let you guys
definitely
hit and finish it up with Dayton. But I need to
go ahead. Have a good one, Jeff.
All right, good night.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Okay, so I guess the next one I would just do is breeding, you know, aside from, I know you already talked about, like, setting up neonates and getting all that stuff going, but what do you do exactly for breeding? When do you introduce, and how do you do so?
So I guess I'm not sure. I do think, you know, I keep both green tree pythons and Amazon tree boas, and I do think there does need to be some cooling to stimulate, follicular growth or an ovulation. So you need to have a nighttime drop. But that's not my breeding stimuli, because I have a year-round nighttime drop, and that doesn't change. I also think you don't have to have as big of a nighttime drop as some people might say, depending on the species.
Okay.
Like I said, my drop gets into the mid-70s. I produce both Amazon tree boas and green tree pythons. So I don't think it needs to go much lower than that for an ovulation or follicular development with those two species.
Okay.
So I have tried introducing my tree boas pretty much any time of the year. But I only get breeding after a certain time, and that's about now. I've gotten breeding as early as December, but that's about the earliest I get. And heading into February, March, April, that's when I get really heavy breeding.
Mm-hmm.
Into June, so. I don't know if I would have to imagine that that's just the weather in my area that is the stimulus for breeding. That's the only other thing. I mean, that's the only thing that's changing. When it gets to be that time, I introduce the males, and I see breeding. I like to mist the cages that I'm breeding, the animals that are in there. I think it stimulates them. They both get active. I think it helps with the smell. They can taste each other. So that would probably be my main factor as far as what I do to stimulate the breeding would be missing
right.
the animals. I lost my train of thought here.
It's okay. So you do introduce boys with girls, and then do they need the trigger of the misting? Like, do you think rain is involved with them triggering?
They don't need it, but I like to do it.
Okay.
Especially if it's raining outside.
Okay.
So if they're feeling what's going on in the weather, I like to simulate that indoors.
That's not a bad
Obviously,
idea.
Obviously, they're not getting rained on.
Right.
So I do that. I introduce my males into my females' cages. That seems to work for the most part. If if I want a particular male to breed and he's not doing not doing that, I do add you know, a different male shed skin in there. I've even put another male in there for, you know, supervised.
Right, the 2 seconds you need to get the boy to kick it in the gear.
Yeah, and, you know, it's pretty obvious, at least with one of the males, one of the males will usually get really spooked. He knows there's another male around in the same, you know, area that he is, and he gets pretty agitated. Yeah, so that's pretty much what I do as far as breeding. And I've noticed my pairings that work out, I'll get frequent early breeding. Like, you'll see frequent copulations really early on in the process.
Okay.
If I don't see the male breeding them in the first night, I don't get anything. Nothing comes of it. The male doesn't breed her later. You know?
Okay, so if it's not right off the bat, then it's probably not going to happen.
Yes.
Okay.
So about 2 weeks ago, I introduced my first pair together, and I had breeding first night. Male was super interested right off the bat. And the female is developing follicles right now. She's swelling. She's getting bigger every day. So I expect an ovulation here pretty soon.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And that's what the Trebo is. So I'm pretty pumped. It's a calico female. And if, you know, I produce calico offspring, it'll be my first calico offspring that I've produced.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So, we're actually going to have to, we're winding down here. We're going to end up having to go on to record soon. So before we get there, did you want to throw out a website or what's going on with Corrales Radio in the next couple episodes or something like that?
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, if you have any questions about Corrales, you could message me on Facebook. It's just my name, Dayton Croydon, on Facebook. Or you could email me. It's my last name, first initial, at yahoo.com. I have a website, HDR. It's www.hdrboreals.weebly.com. You can also check out www.corralisradio.weebly.com. And you can message us on the Corrales Radio on Facebook if you have any questions.
Awesome. So, anything exciting planned for the next episode or two? Or,
man, you know, I feel kind of bad sometimes because Jeff has set up most of our guests.
Don't worry, Eric sets up all our guests. I don't do anything, so it's okay.
Oh, okay. Right?
I understand. Yeah, it's fine.
I'm the co-host, right?
Exactly. I'm the co-host. I'm not the host. That's his job. I show up and key and kind of ground him a little bit, you know.
We're the passion.
No, his passion, his little passion meter thingy, yeah, that's all him. So I just kind of make sure he doesn't go too far. So,
okay. Well, yeah. So I think our next guest is Steve Volk, maybe. But yeah, don't quote me on that. I don't know the lineup, but you can check it out on Facebook. So.
Okay, then we'll definitely check that out.
Right on.
Awesome. So I guess we're going to wind down. So what we'll do is we'll say, you know, thanks for coming on and talking Corrales with us. And we'll catch up with you guys soon and definitely let us know about those, was it the calico babies?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I'm gonna want those. Good luck with that. So we'll just say good night and thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. Well, you have a good night. We'll catch up with you soon.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
Cool. That was a good one,
Eric.
There you are. God damn it.
Yes.
You take yourself off mute.
Yeah, sorry.
Did you hear me bashing you for a good 10 minutes?
Oh, yeah. I heard.
Oh, good. Okay. That's normal business. So
Mute only works the voice, not the hear. You know, the volume. Just saying.
Touche. So, all right.
All right. Let's get this puppy going and let's get the hell out of here. All right, MorelliaPythons.com, the forum, www.MorelliaPythons.com. Go over there, check it out. They are the sponsor of the show. Cool forum, lots of information. Make sure you go over there and participate. MorelliaPythonRadio.com. If you have questions or comments, go to info. You can send it to info@MorelliaPythonRadio.com. If you don't listen live, don't forget you can download us free on iTunes. Check out the Facebook group or page, and you can follow us on Twitter. As far as myself, ebmorelia.com, you can see what we have going on as far as this upcoming season and see what clutches we got. And then the only other last thing I got is Carpet Fest. Check out the Northeast Carpet Fest group for more details. The Northeast is May 17th, and it's in Waldorf, Maryland, hosted by Howard Redding of Redding Reptile Breeders. And the Northwest is July 26th, and that is in Seattle, Washington. And I believe Heather is the one that is sponsoring that. So either way, you got plenty of time to start preparing, take the weekend off. That's a good time to go.
Figure
That's
it out
I got.
And come out. Yeah, definitely.
That's all I got.
Okay, so what we got is I got no immediate shows planned for the near future, but I'll let you know how it goes. Go to Rogue-Reptiles to get all the latest news happening at Rogue. Pretty soon we're going to have eggs start hitting the ground very soon if my females are giving me the signs that I know they're giving me. So it's an exciting time. It's egg season. I love it. So you can contact us through our website, or you can contact us through rogue reptiles at facebook.com. And yeah, that's pretty much all I got. So what we'll say is thanks for listening, and we will catch everybody next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.
Who are you to wave your finger? You must have been out your hair. I hold deep in muddy waters. You're practically ready.